This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I'm your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today is Sam Stepanenko in studio.
I'm in the room.
And out in the islands is in Newfoundland and...
Halifax.
Halifax. Okay, you're in Halifax. Trish is back on the show. It was just a little too far to walk.
Well, yeah, and I was driving across Canada. So the day we would have recorded the last one, I was struggling to find Drummondville. Thank you back.
Wow.
Well, brave, brave soul. That's all I got
to
say.
Jesus. How long did it take you to get from here to there?
It was about 5 days.
Yeah.
The first day I drove all the way to Winnipeg, and that was about 13 hours.
Wow. Jesus. Even getting to Winnipeg in a day, that's awesome.
Yeah. And then Thunder Bay, and then...
You're crazy.
I've made that trip, and I would never do it by road again, I don't think.
I would do it. It got to be hell to do by yourself, but I would totally do it with, you know, a small group of people.
Yeah. Well, I say do it once in your life. That is my thing. It's like, go across Canada once in a vehicle, once in your life. Maybe try not to do it in 5 days, otherwise you can't stop anywhere.
Yeah, you don't really get to see the country, right?
No.
Well, last episode we were thinking that you may have been eaten by a shark. Did you go swimming with any sharks? Is that a goal this time around?
No, not this time around. But what happened was last night we went to the drive-in theater out here in the valley, and we watched Don't Breathe and The Shallows.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. Great drive-in movies.
Yeah, totally.
I know.
Drive-ins are so rare now.
Oh, it was amazing. It was so amazing.
And it's fun, just, I'm sure.
It's another experience. It really is another experience. It's, you can't replicate it in any other way.
Yeah, that is just something you can't replace. And ours went up in a ball of flame in Calgary.
Yes.
So when the Hub Oil had its explosion.
Yeah, it was already closed, though, so it wasn't... It wasn't as big a loss as it would have been if it was still functioning or still operational.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was still, I think there was still the idea people wanted to maybe use it, but nope.
Yeah. Not no more.
Well, yeah, we don't get rid of our drive-ins. We freaking blow them up.
Yes, we go in style. Oh my God. It's like, yeah. I hope the last movie they aired there was an action movie and this was just a delayed explosion.
Yeah, there
yes,
we go.
Yes, and somebody just walking away slowly without looking back at the explosion.
That's right. Well, today we are doing The Impossible. We are going to attempt to remake One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Sam, tell us why.
Oh,
yes,
this
please.
Is my fault.
Fucker.
It is totally my fault. Actually, we were talking about what we're going to do next, and... We'd had a discussion with one of our Twitter followers, Magic Comics, and he had asked, what classic would you remake? Jay had a selection and then encouraged me to do mine, and I suggested Chinatown, and then while Jay and I were talking, I guess Jack Nicholson was in my head, and I went, why don't we do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? And that's how it came to be. So it's Magic Comics' fault that the thought was in my head, but it is my fault for picking it.
See, and I would have gone with Network.
Ooh, that would have been a... Interesting one.
Yes, and we've talked about doing Network a few times. We said at the outset of the show we were kind of avoiding some of these classics that are
true
as perfect movies. And I might have vetoed this if I had seen it before. I hadn't. So
now
that I have, I'm like, oh my God, this is like climbing Everest with your teeth.
Yes, it.
I know.
We've really challenged ourselves this week. And to be honest, I would never remake this film. Like, it should never, ever be remade. But for interest of conversation and discussion, I think this is a great film to talk about.
Oh, yeah. For sure. This thing is a clinic in how to make a movie and how to act in a movie. Like, the performance in this from everybody are stellar.
It really is. It is a truly, truly... moving film, and it's a clinic in how a film should be made.
Yes.
Now, this won what they call the Big Five at the Academy Awards, the second movie to do this since 1934's Happened One Night, and then it wouldn't happen again until Silence of the Lambs in 1991. Now, this movie is from 1975, and it won Best Picture, Actor, Best Actor in a Lead Role, Best Actress in a Lead Role, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. I'm guessing adapted screenplay, obviously.
And now let's talk about the director really quickly. I mean, it's Milos Forman, so you know that it's going to be a beautifully made film. Even given the limitations of cinematography in 1975, it still looks great.
Yeah, absolutely. This guy did Amadeus, Man on the Moon, and The People versus Larry Flint. All fine films.
All fine films, yeah. I mean, it's Milos fucking Forman.
Like, and it's not even just the look, it's just how he shoots. Like the shots that he chooses.
Yeah.
He shoots characters. All of his films are he shoots characters. He picks his settings for them very carefully as well.
Yeah. I guess he spent 4 weeks in the mental hospital they were shooting in with the inmates there. I guess it depends if you've been sent there from prison. Like
McMurphy was an inmate, yes.
Yeah. So yeah, with the patients and just observing, he was just observing for 4 weeks, and you could see that observation on the film. You know, there's actually real patients as background characters within the film, but you can see how he studies people's faces, even in the shots he chooses.
Yeah, no, it's very clear. And I mean, you can tell this is a guy who loves filmmaking.
Oh yeah.
Right. Like he doesn't, I mean, he's got a huge body of work, and I mean, he was working as recently as 2014.
Yeah.
So he's still working. This guy loves what he does, and he's not only a director and a producer, but he's also an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does appear in, not very often, but he does act in films.
Yeah, and I think he actually does appear in one of the bus shots as somebody in the background.
And you know, he may be one of the, maybe like the Stan Lee, he always shows up in his film somewhere, but yeah, in terms of credited speaking roles, I think he's got about half a dozen.
Yeah. Angelica Houston's actually got a little small cameo in the, I think the boat scene.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, cause she, Jack Nicholson had that long relationship.
Yeah.
Right? Oh yeah.
That they were in, actually, it was early on in their relationship, I think, when this movie was made.
Now, okay. So, Milos Forman, this movie stars, and Jesus Christ, like, listen to this list. Jack Nicholson, Louise Fletcher, Michael Berryman, Danny DeVito, Scatman Crothers, Christopher Lloyd, Vincent Schiavelli, Brad Dourif before he became Chucky, William Redfield, Sidney Lassick. It just goes on and on and on. You know, a couple members of Taxi, some future Batman villains, lots of Star Trek people.
it's a litany of up-and-coming stars from the 1970s.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, because for a lot of these actors, it was a first or second appearance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was the first feature for Brad Dourif.
It was. As for Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
For the life of me, cannot remember the name of the actor who plays Chief, but I mean, talk about stellar performances for a guy who has no dialogue for most of the movie. Same with Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this thing about this movie, I think, is how it much gets conveyed without dialogue. I mean, there's a lot of dialogue, but there's so much gets conveyed without it that you almost don't need the dialogue in some of the scenes.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most powerful scenes, actually it happens a couple of times in the movie, but one of the most powerful scenes is during the party. He was going to leave and then sets Billy up with a kind of a date with Candy in one of the other rooms.
A pimp date.
A pimp date. Yep. Pimped him out. Pimped her out. And, let's get him laid before I leave. And he's just sitting there and these reactions on his face. And it's not a quick cut. It sits there for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And you see all these just different states of mind just on his face.
Yes.
And it's so telling. It was, I was just blown away just by that. I mean, there's plenty to be blown away in this movie, but that scene in particular really stood out to me.
Yeah, you can see him making a decision.
Do I stay or is now my time to go?
Yeah, and you see that he actually cares about these people. Like, he didn't think he would. Like, he's changed throughout this movie. Like, this movie changes this character who's a... a very narcissistic character, and you slowly start to see him caring about these friends that he's made in this institution.
Yeah.
But he doesn't realize it until that scene. You can see him realizing it in that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. These people have changed him in profound ways, as he has as well, because he's a very free spirit. He's kind of faked his way into the institution to get out of the work camps of prison.
Not realizing the consequences of it.
Yeah, and, you know, given his rap sheet, he's not an overly nice person. You know, he's surly, gets into fights, drunken disorderlies, and he's in for statutory rape.
Which is not in the book.
Yeah.
He's not as reprehensible.
Yeah, if I'd known we were doing this before, I would have brought the book, which I have bought.
And, you know, statutory rape, he does make a statement when he's talking to the doctor, whether it's true or not is another matter, that she was, you know, ready and willing. But, you know, the law is the law. Whether she's willing or not, if she's underage, is
But let's look at it this way. You've already described him as a narcissist.
Yes.
No matter what happened, it would be her fault.
Yes. Now,
again, he would never admit to any culpability in that instance.
That's
he didn't
true.
Admit he never admitted any culpability in the assault. He's like, "Oh, I just get in fights a lot."
Yeah. And he referenced like a boxer who'd won 40 fights and he's a champion and I get in 5 and I'm a criminal, right?
Mm-hmm. I love that line.
It was a great line.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, it was a great line. I mean, there's a lot of great lines in this movie, almost every line in the script. And a lot of it was improvised by Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Foreman just let him go.
Yeah.
For especially in the group scenes. A lot of those reactions were real because they were reacting to whatever was in Jack's head at the time.
Yeah.
And he's reacting. Everybody in this movie, all of the men with their characters, it's very true. Like, they have a very distinct character. You're never confused as to anybody.
No. Everybody's neuroses and issues are very different and they're noticeable, right?
Mm-hmm. And also you kind of get this, there's a sympathy in the way that they're filmed.
There is, like, because as they reveal later in the movie, most of them are there voluntarily because they're trying to deal with these issues. So, you feel sympathy and empathy for them because they're broken men who are trying to fix themselves.
Yeah, he's really shocked when he finds that out, that they're all there voluntary, and he just views this whole thing as a punishment.
Yes, and then when he finds out that they can hold him indefinitely because he's a prisoner, he's incarcerated.
He's committed as opposed to voluntary.
That's right, yes.
He didn't do his research. And everybody's willing to release him, except Nurse Ratched, who thinks she can help. And I love the complexity of that character.
Mm-hmm.
She really, truly believes in what she's doing is helpful and trying to help these people. But
she's a tyrant.
She's also a tyrant, and when her position of power is challenged, she pushes back, and she holds all the cards. There really is no winning with her.
No, there really isn't.
Yeah, and it's true. Like, what I like, there's the different aspects of it, too. When you talk about how the quiet moments and the camera lingers, she doesn't say much. She'll sit there quietly, and you'll watch her looking at somebody and just waiting. It's a very kind of, like, it reminds me of Devil Wears Prada, Meryl Streep. Mm-hmm. Just, you can say a lot by being quiet and silent.
Yeah, well,
and she's not saying too much.
Yeah, she's got that intense look, and it's funny you say the devil, because that nurse's hat, the way it kind of points up, it sure makes it look like horns.
Yeah, and that may have been deliberate. I mean,
I'm 100% positive it was.
Yes. And, I mean, they made her look so severe. I mean, Louise Fletcher is not an unattractive woman, but they made her look unattractive in this movie, the way they did her hair and her clothing and the look on her face. Like, again, just shows to what a talented actor she is, that her, like, just with her face, she can make you dislike her.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, there's also, like, the parts of it, too, where she in many aspects, she kind of has a point where she's like, if you are going to interfere with these patients' schedule and structured schedule, which can make some people who are mentally ill very unhappy and uncomfortable.
Certainly,
they can get very upset with a change in routine.
No, absolutely. There's no question that I mean, even somebody who considers themselves mostly stable, the changes in my routine mess me up, right? They upset me. I get agitated, right? Like, I have a ritual in the morning, and sorry to my wife, but when she interrupts that routine, I do. I get agitated, right? I'm not at her, but just because my routine's broken. So I imagine what that's like for somebody whose life is built around a routine. Right?
Oh, yes. And so, yeah, it's sort of like she is she is the evil, like she is the villain of the movie, but you kind you see where her villainy kind of comes from, and there's you can see the idea behind it as well.
No, she's not wrong. Very rarely is she wrong. There's only one point in the movie where I think she's truly wrong.
Oh yes,
and yeah, we'll talk about that way near the end of the podcast.
Yeah, she certainly believes everything she's doing is for the benefit of the patients. I don't.
But whether she's right, yeah, that's different.
That is absolutely different. Yeah.
But that's the thing, and it's sort of what happened with McMurphy coming in there is she'd had everything sort of running quote unquote smoothly until he shows up. Now, the unfortunate thing is, like, you can have things running smoothly, but what you have is you have patients who are not going to make any progress.
Yeah, she's more interested in keeping them calm and passive rather than, I think, at least in her mind, she thinks that's helpful, but that's not. It's just kind of maintaining her job.
No, she's really trying to keep them under control.
Yeah.
She's not trying to help them get better.
Yeah, she's more of a warden than somebody helpful. The only time they're in those therapy circles. That's the only time it feels like maybe she's trying to get these guys to engage.
But she calls them meetings. Mm-hmm. That's what drives me nuts, because if it's therapy, it's therapy. But what happens is she's been running these things, which are two things. Where if somebody has a problem with what's going on in the ward, they bring it to her, which makes it more like a meeting. But at certain points, she's asking, well, how do you feel about things? It's too confusing. And it's sort of like, oh, she's running. It's messing people up. Like, I didn't like that. It was.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. You couldn't.
And
really,
she's not a therapist.
Yeah. You really
she
couldn't.
She is.
Yeah. Cause there's another person with her during those. Yeah. She thinks she's a therapist. Mm-hmm,
the other nurse.
Yeah. And you really can't really bring anything to her. Unless you're in one of these circles, they don't engage you outside of those meetings. Not really.
And they introduce the doctor right at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
But you never see him actually interacting with the patients.
Right?
I mean, this really is an institution. It's not care.
Yeah. Dr. Spivey was played by Dean R. Brooks, who's a real doctor.
There we go.
He actually was helpful.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was actually helpful with a lot of the actors when they were in their parts, and because it was such a long shoot, in some cases, like Sidney Lassick, they were getting, and even Danny DeVito. Danny DeVito was really missing his wife at the time, and so he made up an imaginary friend. And he was kind of getting worried. He was losing his mind, mm-hmm. and the doctor basically told him, like, look, as long as you know he's imaginary, you're fine. And Sidney Lassick was just getting lost in the role.
Yeah, because
it was emotionally overwhelming for him.
I can see that. Sidney Lassick plays Charlie Cheswick, right?
Cheswick, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. One of my favorite characters.
Yeah,
so good.
I mean, you can't pick a favorite character in this movie. It's impossible.
Yeah,
no,
it really is impossible.
Why do you think they might think that?
Don't make a bit of sense to me.
Do you think there's anything wrong with your mind, really?
Not a thing, Doc. Excuse me, miss. Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
Your hand is staining my window.
God almighty, she's got you guys coming or going. Change never hurt, huh? A little variety.
Oh, Jesus!
Ah, come on. You're not gonna say that now. You're not gonna say that now. You're gonna pull that henhouse shit now. When the vote the chief just voted, it was 10-9. I want that television set turned on right now!
I don't think he's overly psychotic.
No! I want something done!
I think he's dangerous.
Jesus, I mean, you guys do nothing but complain about how you can't stand it in this place here, and then you haven't got the guts just to walk out. I mean, what do you think you are, for Christ's sake, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
Hey, wait a minute. Hold it!
See how easy it is?
Where
We're from the State Mental Institution. This is Dr. Cheswick, Dr. Tabor, Dr. Scanlon. I'm Dr. McMurphy.
Hey, what? All right, take him over. Get out over here. Get up, Tate.
How about it, you creep, you lunatics, mental defective?
Thank you, Mac. Thank you. I'll never forget you.
Even when you get somebody who doesn't even speak, I think it's Michael Barriman, the creepy horror guy.
Yes.
When he's trying to, when Jack Nicholson's running around trying to get the vote, and there he is, he's like, hey, I'm moving on. I don't even want to talk to him. He scares me.
Yeah. And I like the dancing guy, old guy that wouldn't stop dancing.
Yeah. He just makes you wonder what was in his head. You know, he's living his happiest moment over and over and over, I would think.
That's the best way to look at it, and why not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best thing about movies like this, is you do get to sort of interpret a little bit for yourself.
Oh, they don't spoon feed you at all. Yeah. Like, it's really on the characters' faces. I was really amazed with Danny DeVito, because he's got he does something with his face that really scrunches it up, and it took me a little bit to realize that it was even Danny DeVito. And part of it is I'd never seen this movie, and everybody was so young. I don't think I'd actually seen him that young since Taxi.
He's super young, Danny DeVito.
Yeah, so like the youngest I'd ever seen him was in Taxi, Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, and he'd already started losing his hair at that point.
Yeah.
Right? So
Christopher Lloyd also looking very young.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, Jesus. And his brother there, Vincent Schiavelli. People don't realize they're brothers, but he played Fredrickson, and oh my god, he was so thin. And
yes,
I mean, he's long passed, but man, I remember him from also he's one of those guys who was like in every TV series ever made.
He was, and he is a Milos Forman favorite.
Mm-hmm.
He is in Man on the Moon,
mm-hmm.
this obviously, and there's a third one that he was in after this as well, and I've forgotten which one it was. It may have even been The People versus Larry Flint. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't surprise me. I think they became quite close friends on the shoot, and as a result, they worked together frequently.
Right.
Yeah, he's a great actor, and like, okay, you may think he's always played crazy, creepy guy, but there was always more to him in that. But like, I think this might have been the beginning of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not always crazy, creepy guy. I mean, he plays.
Sometimes he's a crazy funny guy.
Crazy funny guy.
True. He was in Ghost.
Yeah. He was great in Ghost.
Dead crazy funny guy.
Yeah. He plays teachers and professors, though. There's probably three or four times where he's played a professor or a teacher.
Oh, yeah. Sort. True. Right.
So I mean, he was more diverse than people realize. He just had such a unique look about him.
Yeah. I think back about Jack Nicholson in the 70s and what was coming out at that time. And a lot of Kubrick movies.
Yes.
You know, like that he had such a great collaboration with Stanley Kubrick. And I think this is actually confused as one of them many times.
Cause I think it is.
You can certainly see some similarities in approach.
Forman and Kubrick did have have very similar looks.
Yeah.
And they both like to focus on character rather than action or even settings or scenery for the most part, right? Like they're really about character-driven film.
Yeah. I got to give Forman credit for maintaining the look of this film. He went through three director of photographies on this film, everything in the hospital is pretty much shot chronologically. Again, we've talked about that in the past, is kind of rare, except for the fishing scene, which was actually the last thing they shot on the shoot. And that's the one that actually had an uncredited DOP, and that's the only scene that does look a little differently.
It was almost a little jarring, and part of it is because you were out of the setting of the hospital.
I feel it works in its favor, if anything
because it does give you a chance to see these characters in a different venue.
Well, Forman actually originally wanted to leave that scene out entirely, but it is powerful, especially for those characters, to just experience something normal as fishing and what that does for them.
Right, and the joy on all of their faces as they're experiencing. But it's just amazing.
See, and for me, part of it too was I thought that that was also to show or indicate sort of how Jack Nicholson got to where he was. Like, why R.P. McMurphy got into so much trouble? Because he pulled these stunts and shenanigans.
Yeah, and I think that definitely works for that character's favor as well. Now, Foreman originally wanted to leave it out to give more impact to the chief leaving at the end. Which, okay, I can kind of see that. But, yeah, it definitely needed to be there, I think, because more characters were driven by that moment than any other.
That's true, yeah. That's where that bond started to form between Murphy and the rest of that group of men.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Because they'd had this really amazing shared experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were able to leave their lives for a little while. Like, this break in their routine helped kind of sort of show them something else that could be achieved.
Well, it was an indicative, it was a very nice juxtaposition to the way Ratched treated them too, right? It's like, stay in your routine, stay in your structure, don't get better, just don't act up, right? Whereas Nicholson was actually helping them grow, right? Albeit unintentionally, but he was doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got Chief, who is completely disengaged from the world. And I don't know if he was there voluntarily or not.
He was there voluntarily. Yeah. We're going to big reveal.
Yeah.
Chief plays a character who's supposedly deaf and mute, but it's actually a scam. He came back from the war, and this was a way for him to get a place to live and 3 square meals a day without having to do anything.
But he also didn't want to. Isn't there the whole scene where he's discussing he didn't want to fall into the thing that his father fell into?
Well, and that's part of it as well. He
can protect himself from himself in this place. That's the other part.
So yeah, but all in all, it was a scam, right? Like he was perfectly sane, but he was so concerned about his own well-being that he felt this was the best thing for him to do, and feigned being mentally ill.
It does it really well.
Does it really well.
Most of the time he's ignoring people, pretending that he just doesn't understand.
He's sweeping.
Yeah, because, I mean, Nicholson's character, McMurphy, is the first person to engage him.
Relentlessly.
Relentlessly. Just, let's talk to this guy. And as soon as everybody called him Chief, I was a little offended by that.
Yeah.
But I guess if there's no other name for the guy, if he's not talking to you, you come up with something.
That's right.
You know.
Now, it actually brings up something very important, a distinction between the movie and the book. And it's harder on film to do this, but the book is told entirely from Chief's point of view.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, nice.
It's his observations of the goings on at this institution.
Yeah. Now, novelist, the guy who wrote the novel, Ken Casey, he originally wrote a draft for the screenplay that was from the point of view, which was, he wasn't willing to negotiate on that, and actually wound up in a lawsuit, which was settled with Milos Forman. I think he wanted about 5% of the gross of the film, and I think they negotiated down to 2.5, because part of the verbal contract was no major changes, which a big change in narrative is definitely a change. And he refused to see the film. He never would watch it. He was so angry about that. He was so adamant about it. And he probably came out okay. He probably, once he got the settlement, this movie was a small budget of $4.4 million and grossed $112 million in the U.S. alone. So, huge hit.
And it's still making money.
And it was number 7 in the highest grossing films at that time.
Yeah, no.
And there's, well, when you're talking about Chief and it being from his perspective, I was going to go back to this where... when you first get the reveal that Chief can speak, where he says, I love juicy food, because of the context of where there's nobody around them, and I thought, like, Jack Nicholson, maybe he snapped, and maybe Chief isn't really speaking. That's what I thought at a certain point in the movie when I first saw this.
The look on his face when Chief does speak. Yeah, so what he goes, juicy fruit.
Yeah, now, and that would have been interesting in of itself. I think that would have been an interesting turn at that moment. It would have made more sense after the electroshock therapy, though, that maybe he is going a little batty. But,
well, you know what, throughout this whole movie, I think that McMurphy is a little bit batty. He is, I mean, he's not textbook insane, but he's definitely narcissistic. He has impulse control issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you do question his actual sanity through a lot of the film because of the way he acts out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So him being institutionalized may not necessarily have been a bad thing for him.
Yeah.
In today's society where they can address those types of things. But in the 60s, where this movie's set, they fry your brain, they give you drugs, and the therapy that we experience now where they try to sort of walk you through and help you with your problems, that didn't really exist in the 60s. It was drug and shock, yeah. Right?
Well, I was listening to like one podcast, and it was like Maria Bamford, she knew Jonathan Winters, and Jonathan Winters had like kind of a long battle with depression and mental illness, and that's what he said. Basically, you go in to the institution, and they'll keep you there for months at a time, but they just kind of give you drugs, and are okay, you're done, and then send you on your way. It's not really you don't get any further, and there's nothing else other than they're like, well, let's just throw some drugs at it. Maybe it'll work.
Yeah, and they treat the electroshock very similarly as well. Like, they are just tossing drugs at these people. And the electroshock is treated treated as a punishment more than anything else. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be therapeutic at all. It's, okay, you guys were disruptive and got into a fight, and now you're going to be punished.
Yeah, and this is going to calm you down.
Yeah.
Yeah, and FYI, nowadays they do still use it, electroconvulsive therapy, for very severe bouts of depression, but you're kind of knocked out and they give you an anticonvulsant. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, no, Sam and I actually have a mutual friend who's gone through it, so.
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
And, I mean, the other thing too is, I mean, like, there is a certain amount of value in it, from what I understand, because it can reset the pathways of the brain for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which, and that's wonderful, but it's still not a cure, right? It's a stopgap measure, right?
Oh, no. It can kind of make more of a kickstart when just the drugs really aren't going to do it. Because the thing with any sort of mental health issue with drugs is, because everybody's brain chemistry is so individual, you got to figure out something. It's always you always kind of roll the dice, try something, roll the dice again, try something else.
Yeah,
try and get the right cocktail.
And you're right. And it is, for a lot of people, it is a cocktail where they're taking a multitude of drugs to try and stay level. And that, I mean, the empathy I have for people who have to deal with depression is, I mean, it's just, baffles me how hard it must be. Like, I can't even comprehend it.
Really,
and it only lasts so long too. Yeah. Yeah. Like, the drugs won't perform the same way over a period of time as well. So you're always going back to square one constantly.
Yeah, no, it is scary. It's just like any other drug or alcohol too, right? The more you use, the more you need.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the way these therapeutic drugs work too, is they only work for so long before your brain's pathways change.
Yeah. Right?
And you're back to square, like you said, to square one.
Yeah. And drugs may not actually be the answer. Much like Billy, the character who had the stutter, there was a person employed on set with a really bad stutter. But given his responsibilities, he was so focused on his responsibilities on set during that time, and it was a very long shoot. By the time he was done, stutter was completely gone. He never had it again.
I love trivia.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of
trivia, I keep meaning to mention this. I wanted to mention this when we mentioned Scatman Crothers in the cast.
Yes.
Wasn't he in The Shining with Nicholson?
Yes, he was.
So that was this. It was
the whole time I'm like, oh no, he's going to die again.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the reasons why everybody thinks that they might be the same filmmaker.
But. Because they're both in it. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting trivia for sure, seeing these actors working together. Because Shining was one of Scatman's last roles, wasn't it?
Think so.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the man, but yeah, it wouldn't be the last, actually there was another actor on this set that, again, Dr. Brooks, he had predicted the actor's death, and he was of why he would die, and I don't remember what actor it was now, but 18 months later the actor would be gone.
Yeah.
Really?
He was a real doctor, so it was probably a proper diagnosis.
Yeah, yeah. It went from cool to creepy, though.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Creepy's cool.
Yeah, that's well, it goes from, like, yeah, cool to being, like, a gypsy curse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it, for sure.
Yeah, actually, I think it was William Redfield Harding. I think he was the one who passed away.
Oh, he was. Now, that's one thing that I wanted to touch base on, too, is that character. I mean, I didn't cast him. I had so much trouble casting what I did cast.
Oh, I didn't know what to do at all.
He is such a critical character.
I had a solution that protected me. And yeah, we'll get there.
We'll get there. But one of the things that's made very clear in the novel that I didn't really get from the movie, and I mean, admittedly, I did have some distractions when I was watching the early part of the movie because we are trying to buy a new home, so I was getting some texts. But yeah, I don't know if they really addressed the fact that he was a homosexual.
They hint at it.
They hint at it. Okay,
but they never outright address it.
Yeah, because that's really, really prominent in the book, from what I understand. It's been so long since I read the book that I don't really recall.
Yeah, there was something about when McMurphy was questioning the medication because he didn't know what it was, so he wasn't going to take it until he knew what the hell it was. And Nurse Ratched's basically going, well, you can take this orally, or we have another option that you'll like a lot less. And he turns around and it's Harding behind him. You'd like that. And Harding's kind of nodding his head.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So,
there is some nods, definitely. Less,
but it's fairly subtle.
Well, homosexuality was considered a mental condition until after this movie came out.
Well, and they do talk about his problems with his wife and his impotency and his jealousy as well. Yeah.
And I do remember that conversation, but I said because I did hear that bit of dialogue about the pills and stuff like that and laughed because it was funny.
Oh yeah,
but I wasn't actually looking at the screen at that particular moment, so I missed that. But I think that's an important thing because Harding's actually a surprisingly central character in the group. Right? Like he seems to be like the, for lack of a better way of putting it, the dad of the group. Like people seem to go to him and talk to him, and he sort of seems to be the leader. They defer to him to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Well, he's more of the academic.
Yeah. Until Nicholson comes in, he is basically the one controlling the ward from the inside. He is the one that everybody looks up to.
Because he doesn't have any real mental issues aside from dealing with his sexuality. Which especially in the 60s, extremely difficult and shameful and obviously caused depression and other mental issues. But as far as his mental capabilities go, he probably was the most capable.
Like he was just trying to control something that was basically not something to be controlled, and I think that was the most upsetting thing, is to be such a guy who was like kind of very intellectual. And he's like, for Pete's sake, why can't I fix this thing?
Right, and exactly. And he's dealing with a stigma rather than a condition.
Yeah. This movie is actually set in the 60s, isn't it?
It is set in the 60s, yes.
I don't think they come out and... Did they come out and say that?
But
there's things like the television. Listening to like the 63 World Series. Yeah the vehicles. So, I mean, granted, it was 1975, so they were a lot closer to the 60s. So having that stuff around and on the sets wouldn't have been too hard.
No, but
yeah, it would be like us going back to the early 2000s.
Yeah. But certainly if you're remaking this movie, it has to stay there.
Yeah.
And it has to stay in the 60s because you need that archaic treatment in the movie because it really is critical, especially if you keep the ending.
Yeah. Now, Kirk Douglas originally bought the rights to this. Like, he read the novel and instantly sought out the rights to this movie and wanted to star in it, but nobody wanted to make it.
And I can see why. It's definitely not the type of film that you would normally expect to be the blockbuster that it was, right? Because it's a very heavy film.
It also involves the idea where somebody says nobody wants to make it, but we've already determined that the original idea is that it's from Chief's perspective. So I can kind of see a movie studio going, well, I'm not making this movie. And once they made that change, that kind of helped it get made.
Yeah. Oh, they got really lucky because that actor, who I don't have in my notes here, that actor.
Will Sampson?
Yeah, Will Sampson. Thank you. Will Sampson was pretty much the last guy to get cast. Like, they couldn't find a Native American of that stature anywhere. And then I do believe it was a recommendation by somebody else working on the film, like, go talk to this guy. And that's how they found. But I'm like literally the last one they found.
I can see that because, like I said, when I'm looking at casting, it's like, you know, you'd have to find a relative unknown actor to cast into that role. I think partly because you want a character that you've never seen if you're remaking this because it's such an important role. I don't think you want anything associated with him prior to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Much of the cast, I mean, at the time were relatively unknown, except for Nicholson, which was very purposeful because Foreman wanted a more established actor because subliminally that would be more attractive as the lead and for the characters on screen.
And also, you kind of have to consider when it was made, when people were choosing parts. It was a weird time. Like, we're now getting to the point where people are like, oh, wait, no, that actor is different than the person on the screen. There are certain roles that people did not want to be associated with. Felt it would really affect their career. They're like, people will think I'm insane. So a young and hungry actor is definitely your better option.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at all of these characters, and they're all very unique looking. Like, every single one of them has a very unique look to them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, none of them are particularly handsome or good looking, but they're very much characters. Like, all of these actors.
See, I don't know, Christopher Lloyd. I'm like, I was kind of surprised by that.
He actually, of all of them, he really did look good. He looked young and fit, and I mean, he still had the Christopher Lloyd eyes, but I mean, he did look good. I'll admit that.
I was actually surprised about his character because it was the most aggressive I've seen him as a character.
Yes. Yeah, no, certainly. It was fun to see him play that type of character.
But then I think about it, I'm like, okay, he was kind of a weird, crazy, aggressive, crazy in Taxi as well. So I think that changed a little later into the 80s.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's not a small guy.
No. There's either. a lot of tall people in this movie.
They are. Yeah. They're all right. And that was, I think that was very deliberate too, because you have actors like Danny DeVito, who's quite short in stature. And then you've got sort of Jack right in the middle, right? And then the rest of them were all kind of imposing looking.
Yeah.
Right?
Actually, it was a little jarring when Jack first meets Will Sampson's character, Chief. And there's a huge difference in height. Like, Will Sampson's, I do believe, was 6'5". Jack Nicholson's 5'10". I mean, they had to have Will Sampson standing on a box. There's a huge difference in height of those characters. And it's the only scene they do that in. Like, they must have had Sampson on a box. But I was kind of puzzled as to why. Maybe just to make that opening scene show how big and imposing that character is, but they never do it again. Like,
no.
But you can also do it, I think it was also to really highlight where Jack Nicholson, R.P. McMurphy, had no fear. He was like, I'm here, I'm going to talk to you. I don't care. That's the way he is. As small as he is, a giant imposing guy like that doesn't face him at all.
Well, they didn't say it, but, you know, he's from prison, so if you're going to rule the roost, you pick the biggest guy in the yard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And that I think maybe that's what...
Instead of being aggressive, he made him friendly. Friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. And that's a big part of McMurphy's personality. Is he's a very friendly guy for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, he'll pick fights, but you know what? You kind of get the impression that that person had to be doing something pretty rotten, right? Or behaving really aggressive to him before he would get into a fight. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You see there's a few moments where he becomes violent, right? And it looks like it's a flaw in his character where he's generally a pretty nice guy, but with the right stimulus, he becomes very, very violent.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, like, it's sort of, he is kind of a nice guy, but he's so much of a narcissist, he's not worth being around a lot. Like, he's definitely a person who's got so much charm and charisma. He does use people.
Oh, for sure.
And then throws them away, but people sort of just end up doing it anyway, and it's sort of sad to watch, but, like, there's nothing stopping him.
No, certainly not. No, but I was talking more in terms of his violent behavior, the violent past that they referred to at the beginning, right? Like, it doesn't seem like he's normally inclined to violence unless there's a certain stimulus. I mean, there's only two scenes where he really does get violent in this movie, right? And they're both scenes are have very specific catalysts for his violence.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
And you see him like have some verbal outbursts as well out of frustration because of his narcissistic nature. Like, he's basically trying to change the environment for his own comfort. You know, okay, they play cards, but they play pinochle. Well, he wants to play blackjack, so he's going to try to teach him how to play blackjack. You know, they go in the yard for breaks, and
he starts basketball.
He starts basketball. They don't know how to play basketball. He tries to, and gradually, as time passes, you see them starting to learn it and to take it on. I mean, I particularly loved it when Chief actually starts to engage and he just saunters from one basket to
that
the other.
That basketball game with the orderlies was great. It was it added a certain amount of levity to, again.
I didn't find it as heavy, I think, as you did until that final 20 minutes. Like, I mean, there's always that threat of challenge in, between McMurphy and Ratched specifically. There's always that challenge and they're both studying each other constantly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the first like 3/4 of the film is really about conflict, right? Like, that's what the movie's about, is the conflict between these two very strong-willed people.
Yeah.
Right, fighting over control of these men who really only need help.
Yeah,
right. I mean, and that's really what the movie's about.
Yeah, and when you starting to see, it was after the electrotherapy, and you starting to see what Ratched's doing to them in those therapy circles, and you can see it on his face. He's staying quiet, but you can see him absorbing what's going on and how much impact he's had on them, and how much better he thinks they're getting. Like, you can see him change, and it's great because it's never vocalized. It's just, and it's all these subtle looks, and just shows the power of the performance.
Well, you see that actually right before the electroshock scene, because it's one of
that's why it happens.
That's right, is because of that scene where she's refusing to recognize the needs of her patients.
Yeah, Cheswick. Yeah, after this point, it's been established that a lot of them are there voluntarily. And Cheswick was like, wait a minute, where's my cigarettes? Why are you withholding my cigarettes?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're mine. Yeah. I bought them.
Yeah. And he starts out
quite reasonably.
Yeah. It's very reasonable. And he's approaching it from an adult standpoint. And he's a very childish mind most of the time. Yes. So, like, wow. You can see him, like, engaging in his, you know, like, he's no longer cowering the corner or kowtowing. He's engaging, and he's like, well, wait a minute, this is mine, this is my right. And eventually he does lose his shit, but
yeah,
that's what causes a lot of problems within that meeting. So
yes, well, and I mean that, and that's finally the catalyst for McMurphy to lose his shit. And
yeah,
I mean, yeah, and he goes and gets the fucking cigarettes for Cheswick. Yeah,
and he is trying to calm Cheswick down. He's actually on Ratched's side a little bit to keep him calm. It's like, well, no, let's keep this discussion going. And he's getting more and more frustrated by it all. So finally he just goes up, smashes the window, grabs the cigarettes.
Well, I don't know. Do you think it also has to do with the fact she also pointed out the reason that we have rationed your cigarettes is because you kept losing them to him in poker?
Well, that was part of it, certainly, right? But at the same time, I think that he was seeing how unresponsive Ratched was to the needs of her patient. This guy had an issue, and she was allowing it to escalate. She allowed it to escalate, right? And nobody else, she did it, because she could have stopped by saying, okay, we'll give you your cigarettes. It would have been that easy. But it was about control for her. It wasn't about making him better. It wasn't about controlling the situation. It was about her controlling him.
Yeah, that was
about it was about treating people also like a child. But to be fair, if you did have a child, be like, I want this now, I want this now. Even if they did buy it, you're not giving it to them. Because she views them as children, not as adults.
Oh, she could have easily relented. It's like, well, after this meeting, I will give you your cigarettes.
Yes.
It could have been as simple as that.
Yes.
This is like the big catalyst of change, especially for McMurphy and her, and really showing where she's starting to make the wrong choices for her patients just to exude that control.
Yeah.
Well, with Cheswick, what I kind of appreciate was the fact people kept trying to come, well, have one of mine. And he's like, no, I want the ones that I bought. I want my ones that I own that are mine.
Yeah. Mm. No, and I mean, you're right. It does go back to the childishness of his behavior and his mind. But ultimately, it's the fault came down to Ratched, because she was the one who refused to acknowledge his very valid point, mm-hmm. right? That they did belong to him. Like, what right does she have to ration them?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, the right she gave was that because they kept losing them and gambling. That's the reason she gave. Doesn't mean it's right. I'm just saying that's how she rationalized it.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. She did give him a reason.
Yeah.
There's also a very funny scene there, too, right before that. What's his name? The older guy. What was it, Warner? Sorry, I don't have the cast list. But the guy with the old father figure, the original father figure.
Harding.
Harding, yeah, sorry. Harding. Yeah. When Harding was having a cigarette and he tried to give it to Cheswick and Cheswick threw it and he's scrambling around looking for that cigarette.
Yes.
And it ends up in...
Christopher Lloyd's pant leg.
Yes.
Now, that's what actually kicks it all off.
Yes. Still
Christopher,
lit.
Yeah, Christopher Lloyd doesn't know it's there and he gets the proverbial hot foot.
Yeah, and he's laughing his ass off while all this is going on. He thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah. But
until his pants catch on fire.
Yeah, but that causes chaos. The orderlies come in to tackle Christopher Lloyd's character because they think he's having an outburst. Mm-hmm. And that just, McMurphy's already having patience issues with this. And now Cheswick is really freaking out about the cigarettes. So that's when he goes, smashes the window, grabs the cigarettes. Then the orderlies tackle him for that and probably should have.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. and then the chief comes in because this is now, they've now bonded and made friends.
Because he's the only, because he's the, Murphy's now the only person he can talk to because he actually has somebody to talk to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, they've bonded quite closely.
Yeah.
So, and then of course this is when they all get electroshock therapy because they were bad boys.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also when you find out chief can speak.
That's right, because
you don't know before this.
Yeah, that's right.
Chief just does this, and that's when you find out that he speaks.
Yeah.
We could talk about every single scene in this movie and talk about how well
they all
tie together.
Yeah, the vote over watching the World Series.
Yeah.
Like, it's all important. Before we get into our casting and stuff, because we know Sam's got a limited schedule today.
Mm-hmm.
Any major points you want to touch on before we get into that portion of the show?
We have to touch on the end. And
yes, we do.
Thank you. I was like, going, we better do that.
I'm not going to skip over the end.
No, we're not.
I wanted to see if there's
anything
else.
Because we want to save the end for the end because it is so fucking powerful.
I gave Sam shit last night via text, and I'm like, you had to pick this fucking movie. So, like, last 15 minutes, a fly flew into my eye. Both eyes, in fact. It was crazy. It was just made me, the fly just made me tear up. I'm like, what the fuck? These little aphids getting into my face.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible. It definitely wasn't the movie.
No. That last 15 minutes is a real roller coaster.
Holy shit, was it ever.
Right. Because it's right from the point where it's the end of the party where.
Now, let's set up the party.
Yes.
Like, this is another. He's decided he's leaving again. He's managed to sneak into the office and get the keys to the window, and he wants to have a party with these people he's bonded with before he leaves. So he calls up Candy, brings some food.
First he brings the two girls in.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He calls up Candy from the office, tells her to bring booze. She brings a friend, and
they bribe Scatman Crothers' character to let them in.
Yeah. With booze, money. With the promise of money, booze, and brats.
Yes.
Yeah. The big three.
The big three, yeah. And they get him drunk, and he passes out.
Yeah.
Well, no. They get him drunk, they get him a woman, and then they proceed to party in the main nurse's station.
That's right.
And then he comes in and has a fit.
Yeah, well, they were supposed to be
trashed.
Yeah, he was under the impression it was just going to be McMurphy and the girl getting laid and just be quiet about it, and he wakes everybody up and has a good old party, and then they go they get into the nurse's station, and of course Scatman's like, you're gonna get me fired. And that's when one of the evening nurses doing her rounds comes through, and he hides everybody, get back in the nursing station. It's actually a pretty humorous moment. And there's a lot of noise going on in there, and Candy pops out, and he's like, "Well,
they put Candy in front of the door."
Yeah,
and it opens, and then he's like, "Well, it gets lonely at night." The nurse totally buys it and goes away.
No, she says that she'd get that woman out of here, right? But
yeah, but she buys the story.
Yes.
Yeah, she didn't realize anybody else is in there.
Yeah, so, and I mean, they have a good old time.
Yeah.
And just before McMurphy and the chief are about to call it a night and call it a day, actually, and take off, McMurphy notices that Billy looks very, very upset that he's leaving. And tries to placate him. He says, "I'll write you a letter with my address on it, and you can get out of there. You can get out of here whenever you want, and come and find me, right? Whenever you're ready to go, right?" Well, he actually says, "Come with me," right? He's grown very attached to Billy. He's very fond of Billy, and he says, "Come with me." And somewhere in his mind, and he gets the idea that if Billy were to finally lose his virginity, he might start to be able to grow and grow that confidence that he's missing, right? And it works.
Yeah, and they do mention earlier that he's attempted suicide several times.
Yeah. So they try it, and it actually does work, right? After this party, and McMurphy decides he's not going to go.
Well, they left that up in the air. Part of me thought, he was contemplating, and then there's a cut scene, and he wakes up. So did he pass out while he was contemplating and waiting? Because he didn't think it was going to take very long.
No.
Yeah, I thought he was waiting and passed out. Like, I think time got away from him.
Yeah, it is
but
kind
that's
of up
the beauty of that scene is, did he make that decision to stick around?
Yeah. And I like to think that he did,
mm-hmm.
but then, of course, he gets ready to go, right? He's ready to go out the window with the girls and Chief, right? Even before Ratchet catches up to them and locks that door again, not realizing that he still has keys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then he does get it open.
And punches the guy.
And then again, he's ready to go. And that's when they find Billy.
But we also skipped over of like kind of why we find Billy is because this is the confidence Billy is missing. But what they never got to was what probably I believe is the main reason for Billy's problem is like this overwhelming fear of his mother.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
What I believe is probably an inappropriate relationship with his mother.
Oh,
somebody that crazy who doesn't like other women touching your son. No.
Yeah. And because this comes down to the most reprehensible thing that Ratchet does in this whole movie.
Yes. That's when she was getting, what happens to her after that. I'm kind of like, ugh.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they peel him
I'm
out
on
of
board
that.
A little bit.
Yeah. They peel him out of that room and get that girl out of there. And the way Billy talks to Ratchet, it's with confidence. He's not stuttering anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Until Ratchet starts making threats. He's like, oh no, I can't have this. And threatens to tell his mother, who she's friends with.
Apparently. Yeah, you know me and your mother are old friends. And as soon as that came out, I'm like, this is it's too much.
And then
he starts stuttering again.
Yeah, his confidence just melts away instantly.
Instantly, he stutters worse than he'd ever had in the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, he regressed to before.
You get the feeling you know why he's there.
Yeah.
His mother has put him there. His mother is an overbearing, like, it is a force in his life that's really just so destructive. But because Nurse Ratchet is quote-unquote friends with her, she's enabling and continuing this type of treatment of Billy.
Oh, and encouraging it from the sounds of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
uh-huh.
Right. So, yeah, it is absolutely reprehensible that Billy's finally made some progress and gained some confidence, and then she pulls out that card on him.
Yeah, I always thought that she would have been fine with people's progress as long as it came from her.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, she locks Billy in a room, or she sends him to the principal's office.
Essentially, the doctor's office.
And says that she's going to call his mom, and it's sort of like you can see.
He's panicked.
He just has a fit because he's panicked. And yeah, that's what sort of drives what happens next.
Yeah,
100%.
This is the catalyst to everything that happens.
Yeah, and during this time, like, McMurphy could have left, but he needs to see what's going on. Like,
he was there for that.
But he could have left. He chose not to.
Yes, and then again, he's ready to go because they've put Billy in the office, and he's got the window open, and he's about to go out.
And the orderlies are already going after Billy. They don't care about him at this point.
Yeah. Well, and that's when the one orderly comes up to him because he's trying to unlock the window.
Yeah,
and then they hear that scream.
Yeah,
that's what keeps him from going out the window is the scream that
the nurse's scream.
The nurse's scream. Mm-hmm. And they all burst into the office and they find that Billy has taken his own life.
Yeah, he broke something and
used flash to cut his throat.
Yes. Yeah. And then I so wish that he had actually killed her.
Oh yeah, this is the rage that crosses his eyes. Yeah. The blame.
Yeah.
It just doesn't even just look at rage, but blame.
Yeah.
Like you can see blame on his face. Yeah. Like this is your fault.
Yeah. You did this.
Yeah.
Right?
You killed him.
And he's choking her. And
oh, he's going to kill her.
He's going to kill her. Right.
Yeah.
And it takes the orderlies a lot of effort to get him off her.
True. Yeah. But you also, the other guys, the other patients, you see some hints of things on their faces where they're like, oh no, he's gone too far. This is very, very bad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like they can see what's happening and they're worried.
Yeah. But this is the moment. Like she broke him right there.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, she broke two people in one go.
Yeah,
this is what she wanted.
Yeah, not something that she did to him directly, but
to somebody that he actually cared about.
Yeah. You know, if I can't get to him, you know, I'll get to him through other people.
Yeah. And the funny thing is the environment itself was fixing him. He was becoming less narcissistic. He actually cared about Chief and about Billy, right? And I mean, the rest of the guys he was friendly with, he didn't care about them the same way.
Yeah, he could have taken that bus at any time. But he chose to let everybody get on board and steal everybody to go on a fishing trip. Yep. You know, he could have gone. He didn't even have to come back.
Nope.
He could have just left that first time. But he didn't. He chose to take everybody out to experience the world because he was already starting to bond with them and realize that they weren't experiencing the world.
Yeah.
See, but I think part of it, like it's sort of there's still a bit of that hinted in narcissism is to do it because he can. And to show everybody else how great he is.
Well, certainly that scene, absolutely.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's all of it. I'm saying there's definitely that undercurrent.
Oh, sure.
And it sort of becomes more of a bonding thing. It didn't really. I don't know if it starts that way.
Oh no, I agree with you. Like he's not there yet, but he's on his way there.
Yeah.
That's what Jay was referring to. Is he's not all the way there, but you're starting to see the signs of that growth, just little ones, right?
Oh, yeah. He definitely likes being the center of attention.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But this is where he chokes Ratchet. And this is one of the places where the book, it deviates quite significantly from the book. In the movie, she has the cervical collar on and the cervical collar?
I don't know. Just call it neck collar.
Cervical collar.
Yeah. On and she can but she still has her voice. She loses her voice in the book.
Yeah.
Right. Because that is her means of control. I think it would be a lot more powerful if she had lost her voice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. So that was something, if I ever were to chance making actually doing a remake on this, I would add that back in, the loss of her voice.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because he's kind of one too, because he's taken her power away from her.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He's made a great, he makes a great sacrifice to do it though.
Yeah.
Right. He does, I mean, sacrifice his sanity to a certain extent. Then, of course, a period of time passes and he comes back to the ward.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite placid, right? Like he's kind of shuffling and he's not really engaging. And it seems to me like the rest of the group just kind of writes it off to his being drugged or...
Well, and he'd already, after the electrotherapy... He already faked that once.
Yes.
You know, he comes in, does the wink, and then lightens up.
Yeah.
But initially, he's playing that prank. So I think, well, and everybody, when they bring him in, everybody's sleeping anyway.
Yes.
So right. Really, it's only the chief who's...
That sort of sees him, that's right.
Yeah. And he doesn't get the wink, so he worries.
Yeah. And another thing that's different in the movie is, in the book, the only person left from the group is Chief. The rest of them he's segregated for so long that the rest of the group has moved on, right? So it's a whole new group of people. Like the group of people that he knew and became fond of and cared for aren't there anymore, right? And that provides more motivation for Chief to leave, and that's why it's so important for him to leave, is because the people that he had grown to know and love are gone too. He's the only one left, or I think there might be one other person left, but. Most of the people that were a part of that original group are gone.
Yeah, either, you know, a couple died, I think, in the book.
Yeah, Cheswick dies in the book, and then, of course, Billy dies in the book.
Yeah.
I think those are the only two of the group that do pass, though.
Yeah.
So, there's this big change there, too. I think that's part of Chief's motivation, but by changing the story, I guess, from Chief's point of view, it's not as clear and it's not as important that the original group's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But Chief becomes, he's like, I want to go and let's go now. And
yeah,
he goes to try and wake up McMurphy. And McMurphy's not responding, and he doesn't understand. It's all, at first, he doesn't really understand why.
And there's nothing really behind the eyes either.
There's nothing really behind the eyes. Like, he's gone. Mm-hmm. And then he sees the lobotomy scars on the on his forehead and becomes very distraught.
Yeah.
Right. Like, hugs him and you almost cry. Like, almost. I don't think he actually cries until after he hugs him and lays him back down.
Yeah. He's like, no, no, you're not leaving without me.
Yeah.
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 Which makes you wonder where he's going.
Yes. And then proceeds to
snuff
out McMurphy's life because McMurphy's not there anymore.
Yeah. It was a.
Well, I don't know. That life was snuffed out. What he was doing was what he believed to be, like, just kind of. McMurphy would never have wanted to live like that.
No, exactly. And it was an act of mercy. There's no question. It was an act of mercy. Because the person who was there is gone.
Yeah.
Trust me, if that was me, you guys would smother me, right?
Yeah, I'd.
Okay, good. I'll do the same for you.
Yeah, because, you know, propping you up in front of a microphone, you wouldn't be that as near as interesting.
No.
No, no. And this would be, it would not help the podcast at all.
No.
No. No, but, and again, if you've not seen the movie or read the book or heard about it, which I think most of our listeners have at least heard about it.
What are you doing with your life?
Yes.
Yeah.
this should be not a surprise to you, but I will tell you that, as Jay can attest to, even knowing how it ends, seeing that scene is completely different than knowing about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've seen that parodied on The Simpsons and
Spaced did a great parody of it.
Spaced. I never got the chance to watch that damn episode, but I knew
it is super brilliant.
Yeah, you mentioned it to me in text, and I meant to watch it. But I'd seen Spaced a few times, so I knew which one you were talking about, and I wish I had the time to watch it last night. But yeah, lots of things have parodied that the end of that scene, or at least referenced it. You know, it's a seminal moment of film.
It is, and you think you're prepared for it.
Yeah, and even though you've seen it a bazillion times in different movies or whatever, you're not prepared for it. Like, I had not seen this movie. I'd seen pieces of it, and I've seen it in documentaries and things like that, but not in the full context of this movie. And, you know, part of me is really happy that you made us watch this for this film, because I'm not sure when I would have got around to seeing it. I have it. You know, it's in my big Warner collection, but... You know, it was going to be a while before I got to it, I think. And
but the beauty of Will Sampson doing that.
Yeah.
That moment was amazing.
You know, and after he snuffs out his life, he goes to that water fountain. Now, the water fountain was also important. It was initially McMurphy who was thinking, like, I'm going to pick this up. I'm going to make you a bet. I'm going to pick this up and toss it through that window. There's no way. It looks like it's made out of marble, this weird water fountain.
But he was making a point.
It is made out of marble.
Yeah, he was making a point, like, at least I'm going to try. And he did. Like, I guess Nicholson actually got some minor injuries from trying to legitimately lift that thing up. Which means it was fixed. Yeah. And Chief does it. He pulls it off. And carries it, and you could tell it's got some weight to it the way he's moving around, and then tosses it through that window and does what McMurphy had said. And I'm like, hey, he tried.
Yeah. And yeah, then he literally walks off into the sunrise, I guess it is in this case.
Yeah.
But yeah, even having seen it, because I had seen this movie before, it still affected me quite emotionally to that last 10-15 minutes, right up from Billy's death to when Chief walks out. It's just one of the most traumatic and poignant scenes ever put on film.
And yeah,
and see, like, Billy's death, that affects me, like, a lot. I don't know if it affects me. I know McMurphy is supposed to be the one that affects you the most. What I was most affected by was Billy's death, because I'm like, he was just a kid. He was just a poor kid, and she just broke him.
Yeah.
And then just Chief's final realization that he's kind of the guy who's supposed to leave with is gone now.
And there's no way he can live there
just
now.
Just has to go.
There's way too much heartache and pain in that place for him now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But, and Jay and I talked about this when we were talking about doing this movie, and Jay was going to commit sacrilege and talk about changing the ending, and he may still.
I'm basically using this as a loose plot for a brand new movie, because remaking this movie is a sacrilege.
There's no,
I couldn't. Oh, yeah. I rated the, especially we got to the end. I'm like, I can't do this. At least not straight. So I have gone. I wrote a version of
Girl Interrupted.
Well, no, I have gone down a very interesting road that made me chuckle all night long, but. It maybe it was just to make myself feel better after the movie. But I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, and really, again, this movie can't possibly be remade, but if...
It just
can't be, and we're fools for trying this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm sorry, but...
Yeah, it's so hard.
But you know what? I committed to the attempt... So we'll attempt it. I said I wouldn't change much about the movie.
I gave the remake as much seriousness as it deserves. Because, yes. as we said before, no, it should not be remade.
No. And in the highly, highly unlikely that some idiot actually tries it, I hope they go back to the book and tell it the way it was originally told to make it different enough that you're not trying to remake this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Make it do like they did with True Grit, where you... use the original movie as a template, but you go back to the source material to bring out the stuff that was removed from it.
Yeah.
Right? And you'd have to do that.
Yeah.
You absolutely have to do that if you're going to do a straight remake of this movie.
I agree.
Which, if I were going to do it, that's how I would do it anyhow.
Yeah.
Go back to Chief's point of view. Try to tell it from that point of view.
Oh, for sure.
And keep some of those elements in that they did remove, like Cheswick's passing. Adds a little more power to the film that's already really powerful. Maybe it's not necessary, but I would leave that in and have Ratched lose her voice at the end. I think those two things I would definitely keep, or three things, I guess it is. But I think what partly made this movie so powerful was the fact that Jack Nicholson was given free rein to sort of be that narcissistic person and just sort of say whatever was on his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And just deliver it however he felt like delivering it, because it felt very natural.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, since you're already getting into it, do you want to cast your movie?
No. I'm looking at my casting list here, and there's only three, maybe four characters that I would actually try to cast from the existing acting pool of actors.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, I would do what they did. Go with unknown actors, new actors, people that we don't know. Because you need that, I think, in this movie. You need some people who need a chance to sort of really spread their wings and bring something new to these characters. Because you cannot try to recreate these performances.
No.
Right?
No.
So with that in mind, with McMurphy, I picked an actor who is capable of conveying that kind of same type of character, but wouldn't just recreate Jack Nicholson's role whole cloth.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with Adrian Brody.
Okay.
I think that he would bring something really interesting and unique to the role. And then for Nurse Ratched, one of the only two people I cast, actually three, sorry, I went with Julianne Moore.
Mm-hmm.
I think she'd be great as Nurse Ratched. And then I did cast Dr. Spivey, of all people. And the rest of my cast, I'm throwing out. So I went with an actor named Richard Schiff, and everybody who's seen him would recognize him. He looks like a fucking psychiatrist. And he's a great actor. You've seen him in TV and movies all over the place. He's got the balding head, short on the sides, the beard. Like, he just looks like the stereotypical psychiatrist. And then for my director, I actually put a lot of thought into this, and I picked Andrew Dominik, who directed the shooting of Jesse James, or
Assassination of Jesse James
by the coward Robert Ford.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I think that he'd be really great at capturing those characters, right? Because he's proven that he can direct a movie with actors and bring out their best performances. I mean, you had an Academy Award winning.
Oh, well, it wasn't crazy how that movie was shot, but
yeah, and I mean, that might be doing something different to the movie too. When you're looking for an actor who's sort of like a director who's actually an actor's director, I think he'd be a good choice.
Yeah, for sure. What do you got, Trish?
I had so much trouble with McMurphy. I was like, I still don't really have anybody. Because Jack Nicholson, this is such a role that's so him.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anybody who has that level of... I know there's guys that have that level of charisma, but I don't know if they're right for it, you know?
Yes, I do know, which is why, like, I didn't even try.
I know. Like, the closest I got was, like, Robert Downey Jr. I hate Iron Man, but I can kind of get why people like him.
That's ironic, because I used him, too.
Oh, nice!
But you'll see. In a, probably a very different way than you intended.
Okay, for Nurse Ratched, I went with Kate Blanchett, actually.
I love that. That a few times. I just realized out of all, I cast like 18 people, and then I just realized, I'm like, well, shit, I fucking forgot to do my Nurse Ratched. But so I'm choosing yours.
Nice. Sounds good. And Mr. Hardy, Lewis Black.
Oh, nice.
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 I would like to see him in a mental ward just going insane again. I'm like, oh, yes, Lewis Black, do it.
I like I love that.
It. I like that, yes. And maybe that's Chesa- the way you go with the inmates, is these sort of, these up-and-coming comedians,
mm-hmm.
which is a...
Well, Lewis Black is an older comedian.
I mean, a lot of these had great... These actors had great comedy careers, yeah. Yes. So right. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's a good idea. Maybe I should just mm-hmm. rethink this whole thing.
Well, but, I originally was thinking that before I actually watched the movie. Like, I knew some of the cast. I'm like, well, I was thinking in that direction partially, but I'm not as familiar with up-and-coming comedians as Trish would. That would be your strong suit for sure.
But, I mean, the nice thing about comedians is they can capture pathos as well as comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of the guys I did cast is a stand-up. Strange. Well, two of them are stand-ups.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, wow. Okay, so I was inadvertently thinking that. But for Chesik, I put Bill Paxton.
Okay.
Okay.
I thought he could be whiny, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, more childlike, but, like, in a way you don't expect.
Mm-hmm.
For Mr. Martini, Dimitri Martin, a stand-up, I think he could do it. But yeah, he'd be a more vocal Mr. Mm-hmm. Martini.
Very cool.
For Billy, I put Thomas Brody Sangster, who was the kid from Love Actually. Because I was like, okay, oh, this is a sequel to when he says I'm in love and things don't work out for him.
Yeah.
So he ends up in a mental hospital.
Nice tie-in.
Very I know. The Christopher Lloyd, I got Clancy Brown for his character. I couldn't remember his character.
I like that.
I like
because that. I feel that he's an aggressive character and doesn't know... Yeah, he has certain problems with aggression.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't outright fight people, but he just, yeah, he's very confrontational. So I think Clancy Brown would be good. And also very intimidating at the same time, which would be good.
Yeah, yes, totally.
An older version, obviously, but yes.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't going to go young. I was like, for some reason, I feel I want this character. See, some of them, I want them to have been there a long time because it seems like, I don't know if you've ever... You know, set foot around or visited anybody in like a mental area?
I can't say that I have, no.
Well, my grandmother was, when she was around and slipping, she was put in an old folks' facility. And as her mind started to go, they kind of moved her up to that ward. So mm-hmm. I did get to experience some of that confusion that they have, and sometimes just checking out. So it's very different for each person.
Yes.
Yeah. And it sometimes seems to me
it's
to be...
It's scary when from the outside.
It is.
It's got to be scary on the inside, too. Like,
and it sometimes feels like, I don't know, if you spend some time in there, like sometimes it feels like the insanity feeds off each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like having everybody together like that, I know it can sometimes be therapeutic, but it might also be that you're just really feeding their neuroses with other neuroses,
mm-hmm.
and you become crazier while in there.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that, right?
Yeah, there's just the energy that many people with that many problems creates. You know, it's probably something undefinable, but I think there is something to that.
Yeah, well, they do say there's certain... Well, you know how, like, certain... somebody commits suicide in a community, and then there's also a spate of suicides. Mm-hmm. In many ways, mental illness can be contagious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then putting them all into a facility together, it just feels like, let's isolate the contagion.
Yeah, but it's like it becomes an outbreak situation within a very confined space.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's heavy. I'm going to lighten the mood with my casting. Okay, like I said, I don't want to remake this movie, but I did inspire it for contemporary film with a brand new set of characters who play themselves. We have a whole list of crazy Hollywood actors, so I just let them cast themselves.
Nice.
So... Robert Downey Jr., fearing a relapse and having weird delusions while on the set of his latest film, decides he voluntarily checks himself into a Hollywood mental facility. But he's pretty okay. He's our lead character. He's our McMurphy, right? In the facility is Mel Gibson, who hates everyone and everything. Gary Busey, because Gary Busey.
Gary Busey.
Bill Cosby is sentenced and committed there and is kept medically sedated for the whole film. Kiefer Sutherland is always here. He's got a superhero complex and keeps shoving objects up at Bill Cosby's ass. Justin Bieber is my Billy. He's a narcissist overcompensating for impotency and latent homosexuality. He can commit suicide. Nobody's really upset about it. Joaquin Phoenix reverts back to his hip-hop I'm Still Here character for real, and that's due to a head injury he gets on another movie set. Shia LaBeouf is in this movie as well. He hitchhiked to the facility, and he's wearing a bag over his head the whole time.
Oh, wait, no. He's there, but he keeps trying to pretend to be the doctor.
I like it. Please add in as you feel. Yeah. After trying to transfuse real tiger's blood for his own to slow him down, he is put in a mental institution. This is Charlie Sheen.
Constantly in a straitjacket.
Absolutely. Tom Cruise is constantly jumping on furniture for the whole movie and says everybody is faking their disorders. he's always jumping.
And Scientologists are constantly trying to break him out. So the orderlies are constantly trying to beat them out.
I love it.
Good night.
Russell Crowe he's a kind of a combination of our characters, and I'm kind of making him the chief as well. But he's just a very, very angry and antagonistic guy. He's often in restraints and he's super strong.
And Ryan Gosling keeps coming to visit. Because they bonded so much on their other movie, he's like, it's okay, Russ, just let go of the anger, man.
Nicolas Cage is always here. He will only drink out of a dinosaur skull, eat or drink out of a dinosaur skull, and he speaks with periods after every word. Christopher Walken, because Christopher Walken. We've already talked about Kiefer Sutherland. Wesley Snipes also here. He thinks he's Blade. He will only answer to the name Blade, to the point where he constantly even has fake fangs on and sunglasses the whole time. He thinks he's Blade. He's referred to Blade. That's it. This is a reference to Blade Trinity, so go look it up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I've heard the stories.
Nick Nolte is obsessed with his aging and is consistently trying to make himself feel younger than he is. He's the dancing guy, except instead of dancing, he's playing DDR in a corner all the time. That's all he does, is play DDR.
And he's constantly upset Dance Revolution. People keep saying Gary Busey.
Yes. Oh,
he's
I love it.
Nick Nolte.
I love it.
Gary,
are you
okay?
We don't see him very much on screen, but we hear him a lot. Christian Bale is yelling constantly from down the hall.
You see him briefly. He flips out, and then they put him back in the padded room again.
There you go. Crispin Glover is our creepy guy.
Yep.
Yeah. And Jared Leto is always pranking everybody and wants everybody to call him the Joker.
See, but I want Crispin Glover to be the one who's like, who goes out on weekends.
There you go.
Now, he's so voluntary, he just leaves on the weekend.
Now, yes. Now, unless somebody had a better Nurse Ratched, I'm sticking with Trish's Nurse Ratched. And, of course, we also have to have a couple girls show up. Now, I have Lindsay Lohan and Courtney Love show up to have dirty sex with Charlie Sheen and steal everyone's medication.
There we go.
So that is my my cast, that because I can't cast a serious movie, so let's just go with what's already out there.
I know it's Kate Blanchett. You could either have what I feel two women that could probably handle that group of people, You would either have Helen Mirren or Catherine Bigelow.
Oh, I love that. Actually, hold on. And also, I went through a bunch of different crazy directors, and I had a tough time. I was like, maybe David O. Russell. No. Although he's got a great track record for films. How about
you? Make a good Ratchet.
Yeah. How about Uwe Boll? No. He's just, this will be a terrible movie with Uwe Boll. John Waters? Maybe. Lars Van Tier? I don't know. There'd be a lot of flapping dicks. And then I settled on who can handle all this narcissism in this cast. And I went, hey, if he can handle Klaus Kinski, Werner Herzog is the master of the impossible. He can totally control this. So even at 73, he looks like a badass Werner Herzog for my film.
Werner Herzog, wasn't he the one who was once shot doing an interview?
He's a badass, right? Yeah. I don't know about that, but if he was, like, that just cements my director.
Yes.
Like, it may take 10 years to shoot this movie.
Yeah, from what I understand, like, it was a stray bullet during an interview. It wasn't the interviewer shooting Werner Herzog.
Oh, I see. He just took the bullet.
Either way, he took a bullet from somewhere.
And kept going.
Yeah, kept the interview going. Did not stop.
Ow, that fucking hurt. Yeah. Or like, however you say that in German.
Yeah. No, and I think Jay's casting, I think, it really is indicative of how we really feel about this movie, is there's no fucking way it should ever be remade.
Correct.
Right. Trish and I made half-hearted attempts to cast.
Yeah. I realized very quickly that the only way I can cast this was to just have some fun with the cast. I've never really done that before. Let's just go crazy. You know, let's have a blast putting this together. And then it came together really easily.
And actually, yours could be even more accurate to the book, because what you could have is the character of Chief is who they call the director of the reality show that's on set filming a lot of this crap.
Well, and that's just it.
And it's then again from Chief's perspective.
All their crazy is out in public. Like, it's out there. It won't take much to make people believe in it. So they're all just playing themselves. And Robert Downey Jr. is the one that's trying to make them like, hey, I've battled this. I've won over this. So can you. Like, he's still the heart of that movie. And everything still plays.
Yeah.
Except for Billy's death, who nobody gave a shit about. Unless Justin Bieber shows change, which probably he wouldn't. So,
well, I don't know. You did say a lot of people changed during the course of this movie.
That's true.
Perhaps this is what we need to do. Just make this movie so Justin Bieber is
that could be a
out.
Career saver for that boy.
There we go. Yeah.
I just saved his career.
Yeah. You know what? 90 days on set?
And
you never know.
Worst comes to worst, people will just see it just to see him die.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you'd have, like, the Bieber fans, the Beliebers, going, like, just trying, threatening to kill all of us.
Oh, this would get picketed and for sure. No question.
Yeah. You're getting death threats.
It's okay. No Bieber fans listen to this show, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And if are, I don't apologize. This is just for fun. Relax. Yes. I don't have to be a fan.
Yeah.
It's out there. He's nuts.
Look, we're Canadian. And we're a little bit embarrassed.
That's right. We are embarrassed. We are so sorry.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know, I'm glad that we watched this movie.
Me too. Absolutely. This is one of the best films I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, when we were talking briefly, we didn't want to waste our conversation last night because we do that sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, we started texting each other, and it starts. I'm like, no, go to bed.
Yes. Yes, but, yeah, I mean, we talked about how this is damn near a perfect film.
Yeah.
I don't know if a perfect film actually exists, but this is about as close as you're ever going to get.
Yeah, and apparently the Oscars thought so. It's I think, number 33 on the AFI list. Yeah. Top 100 list. It's also in the book 100 Movies You Must See Before You Die, and I agree with that statement. I'm glad I have. Yeah, I mean, I could say glowing things about this movie constantly, and we, like, Jesus, an hour and a half, 2 hours is not long enough to talk about this movie.
No, it really isn't. And I mean, this is one of those movies that really you may only ever see once.
Mm-hmm. Right?
I mean, I've seen it twice, but only because I was wise enough to suggested for the podcast this week. But I probably never would have seen it again otherwise, because I remembered enough to know that it was one of those movies that I don't think I didn't think I could watch a second time. Mm-hmm. It's up there with like Passion of the Christ and stuff like that, where it's just...
Yeah, some of the best movies I've seen, I only ever want to see once, yeah, because they're, yeah, that impactful. And they also bring out emotions that I don't really want to seek again.
No.
I don't like being sad.
Yes.
I sometimes, or even just other uncomfortable feelings, I'm like, yeah, no, not feelings.
Yeah. You know, you're so, and that's why you rewatch popcorn movies, is to escape and just have fun and enjoy the adventure or whatever it is of it all. But the movies I truly appreciate and I think are the best films I've ever watched, I generally only watch once.
Mm-hmm. With very few exceptions.
Yeah, yeah, there's very few exceptions. Once, maybe twice, you know, I'll pull them once a decade or something.
And also the greatest films capture something just a lot deeper. Mm-hmm. And because it's so real, it does cut you a lot deeper. And that's why it's such a great film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Girl Interrupted because it is a great parallel to this, mm-hmm, movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, once was more than enough for that movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that movies about mental illness do tend to affect me particularly powerfully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm not sure why, because I don't know anybody like really closely who suffers from a severe mental illness aside from depression, and I think that's maybe why they affect me so powerfully, is because I can't possibly imagine or comprehend what living like that would be.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's such a different thing. Like mental illness, it's so kind of private, because it's in your head. And trying to get other people to understand is hard. And it's sort of also, mental illness is so erratic and strange and different. And there's no real way, like diabetics, insulin, that's the solution. But mental illness, there's nothing real that can be held on to. Like they've tried, mm-hmm, so many things, mm-hmm, and it's so unknowable.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because you hear terms like that's textbook narcissism, or that's textbook depression, or textbook bipolar disorder, or whatever the case may be, but they always say textbook, and I don't think there's anything textbook about mental, mm-hmm, illnesses.
No, you maybe will categorize it, but and you know, it checks a lot of boxes, but at the end of the day, it's still very unique to that individual.
It's a very,
yeah, and we'll
thing,
even,
yeah,
within, mm-hmm, each disorder, there's a spectrum of severity and, mm-hmm, symptoms. Like even when you kind of get something that's diagnosed, like, okay, so you've got like a bipolar disorder, there's still other spectrums within bipolar,
mm-hmm,
that people fall into, and substrands. And it's not, it's so, there's so much to it.
There is. And I mean, we've, again, not having like very much personal experience with it, I think that's what makes this movie and other movies about mental illness so powerful,
right? Mm-hmm.
Is,
mm-hmm,
because it gives you some insight into how good we have it.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. With whatever minor OCDs and neuroses that I might have, my life's pretty damn good. And I think that's why it's difficult for me to watch those, because it does make me realize that I have things good. And it also makes me realize that there are people out there who don't, who have, yeah, to live with this every single day.
Now, like, mental health care has changed a lot. So, mm-hmm, if you've seen this movie and may have your own problems, that might scare you away from seeking help. Don't let that do that for,
no,
you.
No, please,
yeah,
don't.
But I mean, also, we're in Canada, and getting help is a different proposition, mm-hmm, than having to pay for help,
yeah,
elsewhere.
That is also very true.
Yeah, we definitely have it better than a lot of countries.
Yeah, mm-hmm, because it is a lot more readily accessible to us.
Yeah. Well, that was a fun and heavy episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably the heaviest episode we've ever done, and probably the most challenging I've been in on.
Yeah, I'm glad I went the way I did, because just when the credits rolled, I'm like, I was just instantly agonizing over how to cast this, and I'm like, you can't. How can you? And once I kind of clued into a path, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This will be easy to cast now. I'm like, I don't want to make that movie. I want to make a different movie that follows the same line.
Yeah, mm-hmm, because as we've said already, you can't.
Yeah.
Just no, you can't.
Yeah. I'll call mine A Bunch of Cuckoos Flew Over Hollywood.
There we go.
Yeah.
a bunch of cuckoos flew the Hollywood nest.
Yeah. All right. Well, this was an intense episode. We're not going to tackle classics very often, but every now and again, we've now done one of Sam's. We might put one of mine to task. We might put one of Trish's to tasks, but we'll spread them out. It's going to be a while before we tackle another one like this.
Yeah, we can't do this all the time.
No. If our audience has suggestions of a classic they think they would be remade, we will gladly ridicule your choices on air. You can tell us what those choices are at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook. And, of course, you can email your comments, suggestions, corrections, and classics that we will make fun of you for at Invasion of the Remake, all one word, at gmail.com. It's invasionoftheremake@gmail.com. You see us post about an episode or anything else on social media. If you see us posting, give us a retweet, give us a repost on Facebook. The more people who see our posts, the more people that will discover the podcast. And of course, another way you can help support the show is go to iTunes. Go there, write us a short review, give us 5 stars. It helps us out. Gets us maybe featured on the front page and gets a lot of eyeballs on the show. They use the comments and the ratings to help decide who goes there. And we only got a couple of comments there so far. So come on, guys. We don't ask you for any money. We give you all this free content every month. So just go over there. Takes no time at all. Just take 30 seconds out of your day.
And you're not the other patients on the ward. We don't need your votes. We need the guys in the main meeting.
That's right.
Give us something. Right.
There we go. So yes, please tell your friends.
Yes, tell your friends, tell everybody, because this show rocks. We are now into our second year, and Trish wasn't here for it. We had a 2-part episode while you were away about all of the remakes that are coming up or that have been scheduled or optioned or whatnot. And the one I think you're going to be most upset about, Trish.
Yeah.
Clue is on that list.
Okay, I will get on board with that if I'm in it.
Well, there you go. Well, I had a very different take on it because I just you know what, you listen to the episode too.
I do that. I do my homework.
That's right. So you'll see, we can have that discussion after that episode is aired. I think that one will be that was in our first part episode, so you'll hear that pretty quick.
Okay.
That'll be going up, for everybody, it will be, as of this recording, it'll already be up, but it'll be up Wednesday, July the 31st. August the 31st.
August 31st.
What month are we in? It's August.
Yeah. We're in August.
Yeah, by the time you hear this episode, it'll be September, so. Man, this year's gone by fast.
Well, you know, considering what the hell's been happening in it, let's just make it go faster and just leave it behind.
No, too many awesome talents have died this year. I don't want to rush it.
Yes.
No, but I'm like going, if we power through, maybe we'll avoid a few.
Yeah, well.
Like, just get it done.
I mean, based on all the remakes that are on that list, we are going to be doing this a very long time. the invasion is never going to end.
Yeah, we have at least 4 years worth of stuff to talk about just for our remade episodes.
Yeah.
So, because there's 109 on there. So
and that's the ones that haven't come out. The ones that are behind us.
Yes. So we have a wealth of material to talk about. And
essentially what might happen is the episodes where we try to remake something, we'll have trouble finding those because everything's being remade.
Well, there was some stuff on that list that we had talked about possibly doing, and now they're showing up on the lists.
Yeah, so. Some stuff. Well, I don't know. I mean, we did Logan's Run. Some of these things gestate for a very long time, so we might beat some of these other movies to the punch. And
for sure.
That's fine. Everybody seemed to really enjoy the Logan's Run episodes, so I'm not going to shy away from them anymore if they are coming up, unless they're around the corner.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, if they're coming out within a year, then there's no point in us turning a remake.
And that gives our chances to listen to go, hey, they were right. If that would have been a good remake, why'd you guys do it the way you did? Right?
Yeah, that's right. Why didn't you listen to the people on this show?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what this is going to come into. They might just, maybe that's it. They're listening to our podcast and they're just doing it on their own.
We're getting to a point where we might start seeing that. See, maybe some of our suggestions will make it to screen. I hope so.
We hope.
You know, credit us. I don't know. Have somebody listening to the podcast in the background of your movie. That is payment enough.
Yes.
or have the thanks. We want the thanks at the end. Special thanks too.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. We don't need residuals.
No.
But we'll take them.
or free tickets to the premiere.
Yeah.
I'm not going to shy away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah. Fly us down.
No narcissism here at all. All right. Well, we're going to put the cuckoos back in the nest. I've been Jason.
I'm Sam.
I'm Trish.
And guess what? We're out of here. Actually, Trish is already out of here. She's way out of here. She's in the other end of the country.
I'll be back in there.
Soon.
Yes.
When do you get back?
I'm back on Wednesday.
Okay. So you'll be in studio next week.
So are you driving back?
No, I'm flying back.
Okay.
The point was to drive the truck out and then, get that dealt with.
Thank goodness, because that would have been tough.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm crazy, but, I'm only a certain level of crazy.
One way only. I get it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to close out the show. We can always chat a little bit more off recording. So.
Okay.
Okay, we're out of here, guys. Again.
All right. Bye.